Thanks for joining us. I'm Frank Sesno of the George Washington University and host of Planet Forward, sitting in for Diane Rehm today. Ayn Rand's novels, Atlas Shrugged and Fountainhead, were both published more than 50 years ago now, but the ideas she fiercely espoused, the virtues of laissez-faire capitalism, individual rights, and the need to limit the reach of government, among others, remained central to many political and philosophical debates, even today. In a new biography, Anne Heller details the early influences of Ayn Rand's life and her remarkable and controversial contribution to 20th century thought. The book is called Ayn Rand and the World She Made. Ann Heller joins me in the studio. Good to see you.
I'm pleased to be here. Thank you.
Well, I'm pleased to have you here. And it was interesting. We were talking before we went on the air. I asked you, did you study Ayn Rand in college? And you said?
No, I didn't. I stayed away from her in college, concentrated on Herbert Marcuse and things like that.
And you stayed away from her by accident or on purpose?
Well, friends were reading her, and I noticed that they became quite peculiar after having read her.
they became peculiar in what way?
They became true believers, some of them, and began using a kind of language that Rand's true believers use, but that the rest of us don't. Good and evil, in regular conversations, things like that.
So you actually thought they were reading her and becoming somehow misguided?
Well, perhaps overly guided.
Overly guided. Now, interest in her work has sort of ebbed and flowed over the years. How much interest is there now? How much influence is there now?
When I began to write this book, she was really not talked about at all. She's always had a large readership. 300,000 copies of her books are sold just about every year. This year, I think they believe that 2 million copies of her books will be sold.
What's going on?
Because people are seeing parallels between the Obama administration, the financial crisis, the investment in GM, the falling economy, and the world of Atlas Shrugged, as she described it 50 years ago.
So what would she say in Atlas Shrugged? What would she say if she were writing a book today then about this scene that you just described?
She would say that government gets everything wrong and that government cannot run an economy. That when it does, not only does it fail at doing a good job because it's the individual and his creativity that creates economic opportunity and development, but that we tend to lose some of our rights as the government expands its power. She was the founding mother of libertarianism.
Well, I must say you're a captivating writer, and you write in the most engrossing way about her childhood and what she was exposed to growing up, which was the Russian Revolution, and what she saw as the ultimate hijacking of power and authority. Talk about that.
She was born in 1905 in St. Petersburg, Russia. Her name was Alyssa Rosenbaum.
Would you point out her friends didn't know about at the point she died?
No, she never talked about her name.
Or her roots.
Or her family.
Or her heritage.
Yeah. She hated to talk about Russia. If you knew her or saw her on television, you'd know she had a very thick Russian accent. But she didn't write with a Russian accent, and most people never knew that she was Russian.
So she was born in this sort of pre-revolutionary Russia.
When she was 12 years old, the Bolshevik Revolution happened, and very quickly the bourgeoisie, of which her parents were members, were attacked. Their shops were closed down. The economy, over the course of 2 or 3 years, became completely under the thumb of the state. She was in her father's store when the soldiers marched in and shuttered it and put a red sticker on it, "Do not enter here." And after that, her father never worked again. He refused to work.
He never worked again.
He refused to work for the Bolsheviks and later the communists, and there was no other kind of work to have.
And they were forced to flee. They fled for some number of time. And you write about this sort of family trek and back again in and this incredible train ride that they experienced after the revolution when the country had been utterly bankrupted. Talk about some of these experiences, because she and her family were really witness to this revolution.
Absolutely, they were. They waited as long as they could, believing that this couldn't last, that people were too smart for this.
And where were they at the time?
They were in St. Petersburg.
Which isn't the ultimate capital of contrasts.
Yes, it is. Indeed, it is. After 2 or 3 years, they realized that that nothing was going to change in St. Petersburg for in the short term. So they fled to the Crimea on the Black Sea, where the last place where Lenin and his troops had not yet come and taken over. And she went to high school there. And when she was 16, the Red Army invaded, and that was the end of that. And the family went back to St. Petersburg, hoping to recover their property on a slow train that is beautifully described in We the Living, crowded from stem to stern with people who have nothing, who have waited on the platforms for days and sometimes weeks for a train. The trains were very irregular, very broken down and slow, who had nothing to eat, who had no property to carry with them, and were just trying to head home.
What did she see? What did she experience on her train ride?
She looked upon the people on the train with her as unsavory characters. She was always thinking about what the world should look like. And certainly people who were frightened and poor and forced to steal in order to eat were not what she thought the world should look like. When they came to St. Petersburg and got off the train, she saw red banners and warnings against cholera and typhus and dirt and poverty, and her city was entirely changed from a fairly prosperous Renaissance city, Enlightenment city, into a drab tyranny.
Now, I think one of the things that's so interesting and so important to understand her and her development then is the privation that she and her family experienced and shared as Lenin and his henchmen imposed their revolution, right down to the number of calories that someone could consume a day, mm-hmm. the kind of food that was available, the kind of living conditions as the bourgeoisie were pushed out and the landholders were pushed out and forced to share their dwellings with perfect strangers or illiterate peasants or whatever. So talk about that a little bit, what she and really Russia was experiencing in those years.
One of the ironies of the revolution that wasn't lost on Ayn Rand was that the farmers in the south, the Ukraine had always been the breadbasket of Russia. But the farmers in the south stopped shipping their grain north because they couldn't get a decent price for it. So they'd hoard it or they'd destroy it. And as a result, the city starved. And food was more and more rationed until I think it did get to it. The ration for food was 1,000 calories a day, and it was mostly in grain that was often rotten. Maybe some peas or potato peelings when one was lucky. Lard could be had on the black market, but everybody was starving, and there was no fuel. There was no electricity. The houses were dark and the streets were dangerous and everybody was hungry.
And this revolution and her sort of budding adolescence and adulthood was taking place in the midst of and the immediate aftermath of World War I, which had been brutal for Russia, then the Soviet Union.
Yes, that's absolutely true. Russia never recovered from World War I. One could argue that it never recovered from World War I until World War II. But what she was an astonishingly intelligent little girl, and what she saw all around her was hypocrisy. All power to the people. Well, the people had no power whatsoever. It was the state that had acquired huge amounts of power, by overthrowing the Tsarist Republic.
So not only do we have this extraordinary young woman experiencing this around her, but she's also emerging as a philosopher through this period of time. And you write about her adolescence and her own reflection on her adolescence and what she referred to as the pre-philosophy of this time. And here's what you write. The job of the adolescent, she explained, is to integrate the likes and dislikes of childhood into a coherent, if subconscious, sense of life, which she defined as an implicit appraisal of the nature of the world. Is the world understandable or incoherent? Do people have the power of choice, or are they servants of destiny? Can a person achieve his goal, or is he helpless against the designs of an all-powerful God or a malevolent universe? Depending on how the child answers, he will become a self-assured creature or a passive social parasite.
Oh, yes. What an amazing girl she was. She decided that what she was for in her adolescence. She was for self-creation. She was for a sense of optimism that she could do anything she wanted to do, and so could anybody else, given their natural gifts, and that the state and deity and duty had no right to stop her.
Deity had no right to stop her.
She became an atheist.
When?
A very outspoken atheist. She decided she didn't believe in God at the age of 13, and I remarked that this was bar mitzvah age. She was a Jewish girl. I mean, it may just be a coincidence, but not necessarily. And when she was in her 20s, she became very vocal.
Did she reject Judaism?
Oh, yes.
So she rejected the whole religious experience.
Idea of God.
We are talking with Ann Heller, author of Ayn Rand and The World She Made. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. I'm Frank Sesno. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. I'm Frank Sesno. Thanks for joining us. We're talking today with Ann Heller, author of Ayn Rand and The World She Made. And, of course, Ayn Rand, author of so many books, and Atlas Shrugged, of course, and Fountainhead being first among them, with so much influence, so much of a following. Ann Heller, you mentioned just a moment ago that she's selling something like 2 million books a year now. Is
2 million copies of those two novels this year.
That is just unbelievable.
Which, if it happens, will be double what was sold last year.
We want to invite our listeners, many of whom I am sure have read Ayn Rand's works or are familiar with her philosophy. Call us at 1-800-433-8850. Send us an email to drshow@wamu.org. Ann Heller, you mentioned earlier you hadn't read her books. You actually rather studiously avoided them in college. And as I understand it, you first became interested when you were working for a magazine and somebody mailed you the money speech from Atlas Shrugged. What happened? What was the speech? What was your reaction?
The speech begins, the speech is given by a copper baron at the wedding of one of the novel's villains. And he says all of this to a group of, liberal lobbyists and bureaucrats. And what he says is, you think that money is the root of all evil. Well, let me tell you, it is the root of all good. And he goes on to make the case that money economy is the only alternative to an economy by faith or an economy by force. And having been brought up in the Judeo-Christian tradition and being a liberal by temperament, I found this rather a new thought. And
a new thought that money was good?
That money was the root of good, that money is the means to good. But she made the argument very persuasively over the course of 5 or 6 pages, and I found it very challenging. And so I read her novels for the first time and found those very much more interesting than I had expected, and went on to read more of Ayn Rand.
Now, as you read more of Ayn Rand, though, you were not allowed access to her collection of personal papers in Irvine, California, as I understand it. Why? What happened?
That's true. Well, I was told a number of things. I was told that somebody else was working on a biography, a professor at Virginia Tech, who's associated with the Institute, and she had exclusive access. I was told that by Leonard Peikoff in an email that I had nothing in common with him or with the Institute.
What did that mean?
From my previous writing, he decided that I was not a objectivist or a fan of Ayn Rand, and therefore he didn't want anything to do with me. The papers are in his keeping, so he makes the ultimate decision about whether they can be seen or not, and they've been seen by very few people.
Did Ayn Rand need to be surrounded by acolytes?
I don't think so. The acolytes were drawn and organized, consciously organized, by her chief disciple and lover, Nathaniel Brandon. And she certainly relished the attention and the adoration as time went on. Would she have collected these people on her own? I think not.
There's one name that's a very influential name with strong connections to Ayn Rand. I'd like you to talk about that. Alan Greenspan.
Oh, yes. Alan Greenspan met her in the middle 50s, and he was quite skeptical of her and her thinking. And she, in turn, was quite skeptical of his potential. He was silent. He didn't talk enough. He came to her because somebody that she was very close to, a young person, married him. And he began to attend Saturday night salons at Ayn Rand's apartment. And she called him the undertaker because he always dressed in dark suits. He was a little older than her other acolytes. And he didn't say very much. And he had a glum look on his face. As she got to know him better, and he began to participate in the discussions of Atlas Shrugged, which was being written as they listened to her read it, she decided that he was brilliant, and she began to call him the sleeping giant. And he, in turn, has always said that she put the moral basis under capitalism for him. And he's remained devoted to her, never said a word against her until this day.
And did you see her influence in his actions as he progressed through his career? I mean, he had such enormous influence on this country and the world economy.
He did. Indeed, he did. And her influence was hard to see in his practical work. She would have had him take us back to the gold standard. She would have had him, instead of saving Social Security, help to abolish it. She would have had him help to shrink government rather than to expand the money supply, as we've done regularly for all these many years. However, after he retired and when he spoke to the Congress last fall about the financial crisis, it seemed to me that he was, for the first time, retracting explicitly some of the things that he came to believe when he was under her auspices.
Such as?
For example, that businessmen having their own, or bankers, or investment bankers, having their own long-term interests at heart could be depended on to be honorable people, that they would be destroying their own long-term business prospects by cheating or evading the rules or harming their customers in any way. And he said, you know, I thought that for a long time, and now I have to say it may not be true.
Ann Heller, we have an email here speaking of the kind of people she wanted to be surrounded by and all, from John, who says, please discuss Rand's rather nutty aesthetic pronouncements concerning art and music that her followers were expected to share, the cult of personality she demanded in her personal life when against all the heavy-breathing individualism she incorporated into her books. John says she was a self-proclaimed philosopher. I consider her an author. Very disturbing that Greenspan was dopey enough to become a follower, considering the havoc his policies have wreaked in America.
Well, it is astonishing that he was at the peak of financial power for decades and didn't revise his views, apparently, about this issue, if not others. You know, her followers and she were both aware that this was a contradiction, that she espoused individualism and demanded complete loyalty. But her explanation was that she was right and that anybody who deviated from what she thought was not a real individualist and could go elsewhere. So she had a bit of a tautology going that nobody could get away with but somebody who was extremely smart
and
good in argument.
Interesting email from Michael here, who says, don't you think that Rand got it wrong with her apparent fear that government would be usurped by the workers at the expense of the capitalists to take advantage of their initiative and inventiveness?
I'm not sure that she thought exactly that, but she certainly did think that the union movement and the loud complaints of liberals that, you know, workers were being misused by their bosses, the capitalists, had it backward, that the capitalists created the wealth and that our standard of living, all of us, rose as the capitalists created more wealth, that it's not a zero-sum game, but a game whose rewards are expanded by brilliant capitalists.
She was, as we've said, a philosopher who turned this philosophy into a worldview and expressed it in a variety of ways, to include through these very influential novels that were and are big sellers. Her formative years at university, for example, when she was still in Russia, she saw students get expelled. She was one of them as the communist wave crested. She saw some of her favorite professors and others put on the, you know, on the ship and deported from the country. And you write, she learned to detest Plato and his mysticism, which is how she regarded the Platonic belief that the observable world is a mere shadow of ideal forms that can't be seen. How did that influence her, the rest of her philosophical and worldview? She had this, you know, she studied these early philosophers, but she broke so profoundly with this kind of Platonic sense of the world and the observable.
She lived in a society that even after the revolution was intensely religious and mystical. And I think she probably early on identified Plato rightly with a belief in another world, a better world. And she ended up siding squarely with Aristotle that what you see is what you get, that there is no other world and this is it. And I think her early experience of seeing the power of the state probably reinforced that feeling in her.
Okay, let me ask you this now. We've tracked her early years in Russia. How did she get to the United States, and what was her early experience in the United States like?
Her family, her extended family, took all her money and their money and helped her to gain passage to the United States after some cousins that they had here had sponsored her for a passport and a visa. She was supposed to stay here for 6 months, but she stayed here for the rest of her life. She landed in New York, as everybody did then, at Ellis Island. And the first thing she saw was the skyline of Manhattan, which more than anything else represented to her the beacon of freedom, creativity, talent, productivity, wealth, limitless aspiration. She'd seen the New York skyline in movies in St. Petersburg, and it remained her icon for the rest of her life.
We invite our listeners to join us at 1-800-433-8850, and you can email us at drshow@wamu.org. to join our conversation. We're going to pick up your comments and your questions in just a moment here. You write that her early years in America were hard, but not as hard as she described or claimed. What's the disconnect? What happened?
As an accomplished author, Ayn Rand looked back and saw that nobody had helped her in any way, that she'd done it all herself. And it's while it's true that she, when she came to the United States, she had to work as an extra on movie scenes and as a waitress and a clerk, it's not true that she didn't have any help. The first thing that happened to her when she got here was that she became a pet of Cecil B. DeMille, who gave her some of her first jobs as a junior screenwriter, even though she didn't speak much English. She also had help from her parents, her family in Chicago. Many people went out of their way in Hollywood and New York both to bring her talent to the attention of other people. But she saw herself as what she liked to call as a self-created soul, and in her older years thought, you know, if I could do this, nobody needs any help. Everybody should be able to do what I did.
I'm Frank Sesno, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. If you'd like to join us, give us a call at 1-800-433-8850. Send us an email to drshow@wamu.org. I'd like to go to the phones now and hear from some of our listeners, many of whom, as I mentioned, have read Ayn Rand and have feelings one way or the other. So let's start with Jake from Chelsea, Michigan. Jake, hi, you're with us and on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, yeah, I had a comment and then sort of a question to go along with it. I'm actually about two-thirds of the way through Atlas Shrugged right now, coincidentally reading it with a couple of college friends. And I'm surprised how sometimes literally on the same page I will be absolutely angered at something that Rand says, and I'll just think, that's baloney, that's not how the world works. And then a paragraph later she'll say something, and it's just brilliant. I'm like, that's awesome, that's so insightful. And it's incredibly a manic reading experience. And having an English degree, I just wonder if there's, given the simplicity I find in her writing, there's a lot of things that are incredibly contrived in Atlas Shrugged, so that she can make her intellectual points. I'm just wondering, is there value in sort of looking at it as a sort of morality play, that this isn't a blueprint for what's going on in America right now, but certainly some of these things may be happening to greater or lesser degree. Is there value in reading the novel as a morality play rather than a warning of what's going on?
Hi, Jake. This is Anne Heller. It's funny that you say that. Everybody, I think, has that experience. I think she's a much better social critic than she is a visionary of how things ought to be. Her prescriptive writing is sometimes, as you say, unreal, and I think a morality play is just the way to describe it. It's a kind of melodrama of ideas, and the characters aren't supposed to be realistic. The settings are, you know, vaguely apocalyptic, but she wants to tell us what's wrong with the society in which we live.
And for the three or four people out there who haven't read it and aren't in the midst of reading it as he's reading it now, give us the cliff notes on Atlas Shrugged.
Atlas Shrugged is the story of a strike by a group of high-powered capitalists who have decided that they are not going to be exploited any longer by the state or by the working people of the country. The setting is something like the Great Depression. The state power is expanding, and these capitalists are disappearing one by one. It's a bit of a mystery story. The heroine, who owns a railroad named Dagny Taggart, is trying to find out where all these people have gone and why the world seems to be falling apart. And the reader follows her journey to the answer to these questions.
And Rand's moral in this morality play is?
Her moral is that it's the creative class, the capitalist class, and the individual, not the state, that creates wealth.
Gregory from Rockford, Illinois, go ahead with your question.
Thank you. I'd like to offer a statement by William Baruti Sr. to kind of encapsulate Rand's own philosophy. He said, a free society, if it is to remain free, cannot permit itself to be dominated by one strain of thought. Unfortunately, her philosophy became dominating and also self-serving, which violated her own moral tenets. Secondly, when Rand denied virtue as its own reward, she made reward the only virtue or the only basis of virtue, reducing the moral basis of her philosophy to a material outcome, which eventually destroyed, I believe, its moral stance and philosophical reality intellectually. Also,
well, let me stop you there and get Anne's response to that. We've got to take a break in a moment anyway, so let there's a lot on the table already.
I think what you might be talking about is her rejection of altruism as something that can be, you know, expected from people or enforced. She believed the basis of individual liberties is the right of the self to work for the self.
Coming up, more of your calls and questions for Anne Heller on The Diane Rehm Show. We'll be right back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide at fordfoundation.org. From the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, informing health reform with policy research, data, and expert commentary on the web at healthreform.org. And by the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, send 44,000 more troops to Afghanistan? Maybe just 15,000 more Marines? We speak with Washington Post Pentagon correspondent Greg Jaffe about the military options facing President Obama. Jaffe is co-author of the new book, The Fourth Star, about the four generals who led the U.S. military's efforts in Iraq. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
And welcome back. I'm Frank Sesno, sitting in today for Diane Rehm. We are talking with Anne Heller. She is the author of Ayn Rand and the World She Made. And judging by the emails and phone calls that have come in so far during our conversation, there are a lot of people who feel strongly about Ayn Rand and I think are going to find some strong things to respond to and to learn perhaps in your book. Here's a question that comes to us via email from John. Is Ayn Rand taken very seriously as a philosopher?
No, John, she's not taken seriously as a philosopher in the academy, which is where philosophy is done. She's taken seriously by a large group of followers that that still stick with her as a philosopher, and in fact, as the ultimate philosopher who can tell us how to live. It was a bitter point with her that she wasn't taken seriously by professors and colleges and universities.
Dell from Florida writes, I'll be interested to see if you relate Ayn Rand to what's happening today in America, the sudden switch to socialism under the Obama administration.
Well, it's certainly, I think, why Ayn Rand is back in the news and why her books are selling so well. People do see great parallels. Rand, and I can't say that I can agree with this, thought that government regulation was at the root of all kind of economic distortion. The government let the economy alone, everything would balance itself and we would be far better off.
Doug joins us now from Utah. Is that Utah? Yeah, it is. Hi, Doug.
Yes. Hi, how are you?
Good. Thanks for your call. Go ahead.
Hey, I have a question with regards to Atlas Shrugged. Rand's secret society in the mountains, I always felt that it could be, as a fan of utopian and dystopian literature, I always felt that it could be argued either way that that was, in fact, a utopian community. If you could comment on that, I'd appreciate it.
Oh, I completely agree with you about that. Rand was a reader of lots of utopian stories in Russia, and I think absolutely that it's a utopia and that the world that it seeks to correct is a dystopia.
Here's another question from Elizabeth, who writes via email. Your guest says that Rand today would say government always gets things wrong. We're coming back to that other question again in the comments you made earlier. The email continues, she was reacting against what communism did to her family. The times are different now. She was an intelligent woman who, seeing the failures of the free market, might well have changed her mind and altered her views. Is that not a possibility? Wasn't she writing for a different time against different threats?
I believe that her premises came from earlier in her life, and that by the time she wrote Atlas Shrugged, they were pretty much solid, and she wasn't going to change them. I think she would see our time as a fulfillment of the apocalyptic vision that she had in Atlas Shrugged of government ruining and the world for the rest of us.
Let me go back to the phones now, and Lydia from Louisville, Kentucky. Hi, Lydia. Go ahead with your question.
Yes, I want to say that I've read pretty much every single novel written by Ayn Rand, and it came from finding her the last couple of years of high school and in college trying to go to an objectivist club meeting only to be drummed out when I claimed that Ayn Rand was a feminist. And it had to do with her female characters being main characters in each of her novels, except for, of course, Anthem, which was about the individual. And I'm wondering if the biographer could comment on perhaps she was reacting to gender discrimination more so than her view that philanthropy, that she was right at the height of its emergence as the beginning of social service programs, and to sort of talk about like the crazy gender dynamics in We the Living of Kira committing suicide by walking towards freedom away from a disaffected layabout slacker lover and giving money from the aberrant wealthy army officer to support the other lover, only to be rejected by both in the end.
Lydia, thanks very much. I think you should write the next book.
Yes. Wow, that was a wonderful synopsis of We the Living. Surely Ayn Rand never let herself be limited by any gender expectations, and neither are, to a large degree, her characters. Dagny in Taggart in Atlas Shrugged has long been thought of as a feminist character. You're surely right about that. However, Ayn Rand herself denied being a feminist. She thought every woman should be a man worshiper. And by that, she didn't mean particularly submissive to men, although many of her female characters are, but rather somebody whose standard is of a heroic male.
You point out something very interesting in the book on this very topic, as a matter of fact, or related to it, and what you refer to as Rand's power-driven sex scenes, which certainly catches the eye, where you quote from her, the embrace is, quoting here, like an act of hatred, like the cutting blow of a lash encircling her body. Dagny, though, you point out, is conscious of surrendering something of far greater import. Whatever pride of person I hold, that is what I offer you for the pleasure of your body. What's the point you're making here? What's the point you feel that she is making here?
She's a great romantic in a you know, lowercase sense. She believes that women should want the best men they can find, and men should want the best women they could find, and that when they give each other their best values, that sex is sizzling as a result.
Here's one It's sizzling. An email from John in Ashburn, Virginia. I put Ayn Rand's philosophy in the same league as Marxist socialism. Both are based on overly optimistic views of human nature and behavior. They both have utopian views of what constitutes social and economic justice. While both make some astute observations about economic systems, their flawed assumptions and conclusions make them unworkable in the real world. You make that connection?
Very interesting. Yes, I can make that connection. And somebody long before I made it very strongly, Whitaker Chambers' famous review of Atlas Shrugged in the National Review made just that point, that her philosophy is materialistic. It rejects any sort of tradition, any sort of connection to the past and to God, and that it and Marxism are basically alike in their celebration of material accomplishment.
Marcus joins us and has been waiting patiently from Cincinnati, Ohio. Hi, Marcus. Go ahead with your question.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. You've mentioned several times during the course of the conversation that there's been a resurgence in Ayn Rand's popularity due to the parallelism, or the obvious parallelism, between today's administration and, say, the society in Atlas Shrugged. However, the parallelism between today's capitalists and the capitalists in Atlas Shrugged, say, Hank Reardon, Dagny Taggart, John Galt, don't appear to be as obvious. And it would seem that Ayn Rand's themes are based on a supposition of honesty and trustworthy among those capitalists, whereas, you know, from Kenneth Lay to Bernie Madoff, that just doesn't appear to be the case. So, I mean, put simply, in your submission of Atlas Shrugged, you say capitalists no longer wanted to be exploited, but today it seems that they are the ones doing the exploiting. What would Ayn Rand's reaction to that observation be?
Interesting question.
Yes, very interesting question. Well, let me give you my reaction first. I was speaking for Ayn Rand and not for the biographer of Ayn Rand when I said that. Ayn Rand would agree with you that the people who we see being hauled away or not being hauled away, the financial people produce nothing. They take money out of the system without putting anything of value back in, and that they are what she loved to call looters and moochers, and I don't think that she would defend them. Her view of the capitalist was a view of the late 19th century titans of American industrialism.
Barons,
the people who built the railroads and the steel plants and refused government help to do these things and did it all on their own and created great wealth. I think that she'd probably like the internet.
Would she think of Bill Gates?
She would like Bill Gates. She would love Bill Gates and the other people who have written software and created.
Why would she like them? I mean, they are, after all, hugely wealthy, very powerful, crush competition.
Well,
they do spread the wealth, though.
She had nothing against crushing competition or being wealthy at all, although that wasn't, I think, her goal. She would admire him because he has created something that has improved the standard of living of all of us, just as she saw the American industrialists.
What do you suppose she'd write about or think about her native Russia now? I mean, the wall falls, the stabs at democracy, but now we see the rise of the oligarchs and a government that is once again squeezing around freedom of expression, democracy, reverting to form, or how would she see this?
Reverting to form. She loathed Russia. I don't think she had any hope that the nature of Russia would change.
So she would not have heralded the New World Order at that moment of jubilation?
Absolutely not. She thought the Russian people themselves were superstitious and not likely to be a democratic society.
How'd she get the idea for Atlas Shrugged that the great minds would go on strike?
The story is that she was talking to a friend of hers in the middle 1940s, just after The Fountainhead was published. And she was her friend was urging her to explain the meaning of The Fountainhead in an essay somewhere so that people would understand it. And she said, why should I do that? what if I just went on strike? What if all the creative minds in the country just went on strike? And she hung up the telephone a little bit later, and her husband said to her, hey, that would make a good novel. And she thought to herself, well, yes, it would.
I'm Frank Sesno, and you are listening to The Diane Rehm Show. If you'd like to join our conversation about Ayn Rand and talk to biographer Ann Heller, please join us at 1-800-433-8850. Send an email to drshow@wamu.org. I will warn you, we've got a lot of people who've called and are waiting, and we've got a lot of emails in the stack here, so we've obviously struck a nerve. So let me get back to the phones now. And Baron joins us from Gainesville, Florida. Hi, go ahead with your comment, question.
Hi, and thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
Your show. I've been a longtime critic of Ayn Rand. I respect the author's book on honor. I think it is an interesting subject. She does raise important questions. But seems to me that her philosophy too often is used as a sort of a unapologetic self-aggrandizement that sort of denies empathy and denies a lot of the sort of social benefits that we're born into, this whole collective, you know, accretion of culture, and then wants to take that and run with it and take all the credit for it and just, you know, I mean mine. And it's disturbing to me, particularly, you know, when there is so much suffering in the world.
Ann Heller.
Yes, Baron, I have to agree with you there. And I spend some time in the book showing that that Ayn Rand herself, even as a child, lacked empathy. I think some people do, and I don't think she could have developed the ideas she did if she had a great deal of empathy for people who were different from her. It's a character trait that some people have and some people don't. I'm not sure. I certainly don't agree with her ideas, but as a challenge to an opposite set of ideas, I find them interesting, and she certainly couldn't have posed them in such an extreme form if she were, you know, sympathetic.
So Keith writes from Maryland via email, I've been under the impression she believes in a capitalism to be conducted at any and all costs. Yes? No?
I don't think she'd agree that costs was the main factor here. She would say that wealth creation is the main factor. Cost to individual human beings? Yes. Yes, indeed. She thought that the rest of us could make up for imbalances with our private charity, but that the government had no right to do that.
So we're joined in our final moment here by Carol from Mesquite, Texas. Hi, Carol. Go ahead with your question.
My question has to do with the process of writing and researching this book. Over what period of time, and what was that like for you?
Thanks very much. Great question.
Hi, Carol. It was 5 years from the time I signed a book contract until I finished the book, and it was the most exciting time and the most fun I've ever had. One of the challenges was talking to the mostly elderly people who had known her and persuading them to talk to me. But there was a lot of archival research, which I found wonderful, too. I love the detective job of uncovering facts.
What surprised you most in your research and in her character?
That she was so fiercely convinced of what it was that she propounded.
Really?
I was amazed that she had no doubt or never expressed any doubt.
Mm-hmm.
It also surprised me that the people, she hurt a lot of people. She was unkind, at times incredibly demanding and cutting and judgmental. But the people who had been the victims of that still loved her and found her the most important person they'd ever known.
And is this someone, and is her work the kind of work that is going to stand up to the ages?
Well, it has so far.
Well, but 50 years isn't the ages. It's a long time.
It's a long time to be selling 2 million copies a year. I don't know, as a literary achievement, maybe not, as novels of ideas, which are so rare at any time, I think yes.
And most interesting element of her personal life?
Her erotic fantasies, her erotic psyche. Fascinating.
Well, on that note, we will conclude our conversation. Ann Heller, author of Ayn Rand and the World She Made. The book is 540-some-odd pages long and a fascinating read on a fascinating and very influential person. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
You've been listening to The Diane Rehm Show. I'm Frank Sesno. Have a very good day.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, and Denise Couture. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR, National Public Radio.